memories can form or stick in our minds. So those kinds of ideas are really, you know, worked into the book at different levels.
And in the coming years, do you see any changes to your writing coming, or do you feel like you've learned even from the past few months after your submission from Into the Poetry and Transit Program? Do you feel like your writing has changed or evolved a bit?
In one sense, it's been a genre shift. Since I finished The Safety Razor, I've been focusing entirely on this anthology of translations that I'm working on and almost done. So that's been, I've written very little of my own poetry over the last, you know, year and a half. And I've just been focusing on the translation. And then I think when I'm done that book of translation, I'll probably go back to a different genre, but I'm not sure what. I have an idea for a novel that's been kind of, you know, kicking around in my brain. So I've written a little bit of it, but we'll see whether that or whether I feel like more poetry. So, yeah.
Well, that would be definitely interesting to read, to be honest. And I look forward to reading about that. That's great. Do you have any advice for future poets or writers or anyone who wants to pick up the pen and doesn't know how to do that?
Yeah, I mean, just like obviously read as much as possible and join a writing group if you can. Writing workshop groups are, you know, amazing. And I think don't be intimidated by feeling you have to write about the same subjects that a lot of people are writing about. I think there are, you know, sometimes there are trendy subjects, and if that's not what you want to write about, just, you know, don't feel that you have to. So yeah, just anything is valid for a subject matter for a poem. And I think sometimes people are maybe afraid when they start that, you know, maybe this subject is not valid or not interesting enough or something, but there's always a way that you can, you know, work your idea, make it broader, make it more specific. You just have to keep working at that.
That's great. Those are all the questions I have for you today, and it's been a pleasure talking to you.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Next up, we have P.W. Bridgman, the pen name of Tom Waits, who is a multifaceted literary figure whose poetry and short fiction have gained recognition in literary circles around the world. With contributions featured in various prestigious literary journals, anthologies in Canada, Ireland, England, Scotland, and the USA, Bridgman has not only garnered awards and distinctions, but has also captivated audiences through in-person readings in locations spanning from British Columbia to Belfast, Dublin, Glasgow, Melbourne, and New York. Beyond his creative pursuits, Bridgman has led a diverse professional life, initially working in child behavior therapy for a decade before transitioning to a 20-year career as a barrister and subsequently serving as a judge for 12 years. His commitment to academic and professional writing is evident in over 90 articles, editorial roles for legal journals, and significant contributions to texts on evidence and civil procedure. Bridgman's literary critique, spanning over 3 decades, is marked by over 50 reviews in prominent Canadian newspapers and a recent resurgence in book reviewing for publication both in the UK and Canada. So first of all, Tom, what led you to use a pen name?
Well, thank you for the kind and generous introduction. I started to write creatively in the mid-80s. I was a law student and soon after that, a lawyer for 20 years and then a judge for another 12. And it seemed to me at the time, I think I won't second guess this now, that it would be a good thing for me to keep my writing life and my professional life, those two lives separate. So I thought the easiest way to do that would be to write under a different name. And this is before the internet era. I thought I was picking a name out of the air. Well, indeed, I did pick the name out of the air. I later discovered that P.W. Bridgman is also the name of a physicist who won a Nobel Prize. That's what happens when you don't have the extensive abilities to search things that we do today. Anyway, to the extent that I wanted to confuse matters, I suppose, and not have anybody put two and two together and figure out who was really lurking behind that pen name, that maybe that was helpful. So I use the pen name just to create a proper distance between the two worlds I operated in. I've done all my creative writing under that name. I'm now retired from the bench for 4 years. There's not the same need to keep those identity separate, but because for better or for worse, my writing is associated with the Bridgman pen name, I've stayed with it. I think because I didn't have to worry much about what I was writing conflicting with my work, I think you asked the question, how did that affect my writing to write under a pen name? I think I felt a little freer. I've not written anything that I think would have ever troubled anyone in my working life, but it's nice to be able to just kind of take one hat off and put on the other and not think too much about how what you're doing in either one of those areas would affect the other.
And are there specific skills or perspective from your previous careers that you find informing your literary work?
All of these things kind of merge. You can't, as much as I might have two hats and operate in two realms, inevitably one is going to infiltrate the other. Of course, my work as a lawyer and later as a judge carries important obligations of confidentiality. So you'll never see anything that actually occurred in my working life showing up in my writing. But if we get beyond the particulars, of course, when you're a lawyer and especially a judge, you are brought into situations and you see humans functioning under very, very difficult circumstances. And you see people tested by life experiences that many of us have never actually had and can barely imagine. That's all going to linger in your mind, and you're going to your thinking is going to be shaped by what you see and hear, and in an entirely anonymous way, it may ultimately shape what happens in your poetry or your fictional writing. You know, that and everything else that you gather up over the course of a lifetime of life experience. These things have a way of influencing what you write, and that's certainly true for me.
And then now you've had many successful careers over the year, which is a remarkable achievement. Then how did you manage to balance the demands of your professional and your creative pursuits? How were you able to go up both of them, wear two hats at the same time, basically?
With difficulty. My writing really didn't start until I was at law school. So it wasn't competing with my time when I was back in the child behavior therapy field. But law, starting as a student, then being a lawyer, and then later being a judge, these are very demanding careers. They're fulfilling and rewarding, but it's no easy task to achieve a balance between your personal life and your professional life. And it was a constant struggle all through my working years. And then trying to do some creative writing in addition simply made that even more challenging. However, if you, and this maybe sounds like a counsel of perfection, but if it matters enough to you to be able to have a creative life in addition to everything else you're doing, then you will make the effort to carve out the time necessary to do it. I'm retired now. I have the luxury of more time on my hands than I ever did when I was working. But it was important enough for me to have this balancing factor, this ability to try to do something very different from what I was doing in my professional life, to make the effort. And so from a practical standpoint, that means not being too fussy about when and where you write. You can't insist on perfect quiet and the perfect surroundings and so on. You have to slip it in when you can, where you can. So I practiced out of a large firm in downtown Vancouver, and if I had a case that I had to go out to deal with in New Westminster, I'd be writing on my laptop on the SkyTrain on the way out and on the way back. The point of that simply being, you seize the moments. You find ways to work it in because it's important enough to be worth the effort. And so it's not easy. I had family responsibilities. I had young kids in the early days. But I managed somehow. Little slivers of time here and there. And somehow I managed to eke out a story or a poem every once in a while.
It's really interesting because like nowadays, it's when you speak to people, it's like they feel like they have to pick between one or the other. It's like, oh, they can only go to professional work or they can only do creative work. So it's interesting to see that we're encouraged to pursue both at the same time. And
it does make sometimes the demands of your professional life are heavy and verging on oppressive. That's just in the nature of the work. Sometimes it's not so, it makes the demands of the professional work more tolerable if you know that you're doing something creative as well. That gives you an outlet. That gives you a sense of accomplishment in an entirely different area. And it somehow it sounds like it's adding to an already kind of impossible calendar or schedule, but it's what it gives back warrants and justifies the extra time and effort.
As someone who's been writing for a long time, I know there have been changes. Like, technology has had an impact on basically every industry, and especially the creative world. How has it been through the decades when it came to your writing? Have you been able to adapt to like the use of technology? Have there been changes, or have you decided to stick to your ways and look like that's what works for you?
Well, I'm not particularly adept with technology. Lydia, my wife, is our in-house IT department, and I always have the benefit of her help. But I was a very early user of home computers. Back when I was in law school, I think it was the Apple II Plus was the generation of computer that was my first one. And I have used a home computer, now a laptop, now an Apple MacBook Air for the entirety of my writing life. So I found that technology very helpful. The ability to edit on screen and so on is something that I had the luxury of right from the beginning, and I couldn't write a story or a poem with a pad of paper and a pen. It's just, this is my mode of writing, and I'm grateful that when I got to be serious about writing creatively, there was a tool that was so so helpful.
Yeah. And how do you integrate your different life experiences into your creative work?
Probably subconsciously. Going back to a point I made before, people who I'm thinking more here of my judging years than my lawyering years, but people who come before you as a judge in a courtroom are in times of very significant conflict. The experience is stressful for them. Most people who you encounter in a courtroom don't spend much time, if any, in courtrooms, and so the surroundings are unfamiliar. The stakes are high, whether it's a criminal prosecution, you're having to make a decision about whether someone, whether the Crown has proven a case against them or not, whether this party or that party in a custody battle is going to prevail. These are all very, very intense and difficult life experiences. And so it's a privilege and a great responsibility to serve in that way in those situations. But you also get glimpses of the way life is lived for people whose life experiences are entirely unlike anything that you've experienced yourself. And again, having all the proper respect for anonymity and confidentiality, being exposed to people in those circumstances creates a kind of rich body of experience yourself that you can then dip into when you're writing creatively. So I feel very fortunate to have been able to play the part that I've played in the justice system for all kinds of reasons, including the fact that it's a very sort of fertile experience in terms of taking things that you have seen and heard properly, stripping them of anything that would identify anyone, and trying to work the lessons you've learned from watching people in those circumstances into writing, which often involves taking characters and plunging them into difficult circumstances and then seeing how they handle it.
Then going into the second portion of this interview, we'll go into the Poetry in Transit program specifically. I spoke to Rob Taylor earlier. He's a juror for the Poetry in Transit program, and he was telling me about how his childhood influenced he being a part of the Poetry in Transit program. I wanted to know for you, what was the main reason you submitted the Idiolect for consideration into the program, and why were you drawn to the program in that way?
I'm a regular user of public transit. I don't want to climb on a soapbox here, but I think responsible people should try to be regular users of public transit and take some of the pressure off our roads and highways and so on, and indirectly achieve other laudable objectives as far as climate change and all of that sort of thing is concerned. So I ride buses and sky trains all the time. And I have over the, 27 or 28 years that Poetry in Transit has been happening. It has enriched my experience as a transit user to be able to look up and once in a while not see an advert, but actually a piece of something of some creative writing that will catch your attention and give you something to ponder while you're on your way from A to B. And I have long thought I would love to have something of my own up there one day. And this year was the second time I made the effort to get something into the Poetry in Transit program. The first year, my work didn't make the cut, but it was an enormous joy for me to open my emails one morning and have notification that something of mine was chosen. I was one of the 10 poets whose work is now circulating throughout BC on buses. I've admired the other work I've seen there. I know that it's a benefit to everyone, writers as well as readers, to have creative writing, poetry particularly, accessible in unexpected places. And, this gets people reading and thinking in places they might not expect to be. And it gets, from the writer's perspective, it gets your work out and seen by people who might never otherwise see it. So I just think Poetry Transit is such a great concept, and to be now part of it is this is a very exciting thing for me.
Yeah, great. It definitely enriches the experience, especially when it comes to transits. That you, as you mentioned, this doesn't have to be ads all the time, but it's like you look up and it's like something new, something different, and something that can actually change how you think or change how you feel in the day. I remember seeing a poem last year, and I was like, oh, this is actually quite refreshing to read, instead of looking up and seeing like an ad for something, or like you see like an ad for a company. But it's actually true. And you mentioned you've seen that work with other poets. Mm-hmm. Was there any specific poets that you've worked with over the past, or that you've loved reading their work, that you would love to work with in the future perhaps?
Without being able to precisely bring the names up into memory right at the moment. I have seen enough good writing over a long enough time to have really felt that Poetry in Transit has made an impact for me. And so that having been the case, I mean, to the point where I'll have made note of something that I first saw in Poetry in Transit and then gone and bought the book of the person because I was interested enough to follow up. For me now to be one of those poets who notionally is riding around on buses speaking to people who are riding on buses too, I love the idea of that. I think it's great. I hope the Poetry in Transit program continues forever. It's a fantastic idea. It's a way to get creative work in front of people who might not otherwise bump into it, and what could be better.
Then I wanted to ask, since the submission was accepted into the program, has there been any change? Have you noticed an uptake from reactions from people about your books or your poetry? Have you received feedback or responses in regards to that?
It's a little too early, I think. I'm expecting I will here and there. I think the Poetry in Transit poems for this year were only put on the buses in either very late August or early September. So they'll be circulating for the next year, and I do think that I will probably occasionally, you know, someone will take a photograph and send it to me or whatever. I saw your poem on the bus, kind of thing. One never knows, you know, what your work being available in a public place is going to do. People are going to see it. They're going to think about it. It's going to set in motion some sort of thought processes. This is the common lament of writers. You often or usually don't know what impact your work is having, but it's out there and it has the potential to have that impact, and that's good enough, really. I mean, you know, you'll get a review once in a while or comment, or someone will say something to you after a reading or whatever, but essentially you let that balloon go, it goes up into the world, and it does what it does, and you hope it gives pleasure and reason to think to as many people as possible, and that's kind of the way it works.
I see. And just going back to your personal life, but then as a writer, we know something. Are there like often times of disappointment where it came like kind of writer's block where it wasn't really clicking, or you didn't feel the passion to write as much as you used to? Was there a period in that time of your life?
Yeah, I mean, I think every writer will tell you that there are ebbs and flows in terms of your creative impulses. There are times when other things that are going on in your life are claiming so much of your time and attention and emotional energy that there just isn't very much left for the creative processes. But then those are followed by times of bursts of creativity, and it's just you can't get too hung up on periodic lapses in your creative output, because if you've been doing it long enough, you know that those will pass and you'll be back into it again. There was a time when I was practicing as a lawyer and I was involved in an enormous case, a trial that went for 184 days. And when I look back at that, and of course there were many, a long, long time leading up to and after that, to where we were just working around the clock. And I look back at my creative output during that time, and there's almost nothing, because there was barely a minute that you could take away from the demands of work. That's an extreme example, but it simply reinforces the point that sometimes life gets in the way, but often you can still fit things in, not under those really extreme circumstances, but if you make the effort, and it does require a determined effort to carve out time for doing things creatively, you'll be able to do it.
Any advice you would have for like young writers or anyone pursuing professional and both creative lines at the same time?
Well, I'm always a little reluctant to give advice because I don't see myself as an authority or an expert, but this sort of picks up on a point I made before. If it matters enough to you, then you ought to make use of the time that you can scrounge from here, there, and everywhere and put that to use to do your writing. In other words, don't worry that you've only got a half hour on the SkyTrain. You can use that half hour and you can take what you were working on then and pick it up and work with it again on another little sliver of time. And cumulatively, that will get you enough time to actually get something written. Waiting for the perfect conditions is a mistake, because generally the perfect conditions are either never or almost never going to be at your disposal. So that's one bit of advice. Develop a thick skin, because it's a tough world out there in terms of getting your work published. Have a thick skin. To the extent you can, learn what you can from a rejection. Usually the rejections are not very detailed. Sometimes they're just form letter. They don't really say anything to you about what it was about your work that made it not suitable. But go into it knowing that the rate of rejection is very high, so that when it starts happening and your work is rejected, you don't feel somehow that you're a failure, that you there's no future in this for you. Anybody who's doing it has taken an awful lot of rejection. I certainly have, and I don't know any writer friends or colleagues who haven't. And you have to be able to endure the disappointment and try and learn as much as you can from what hasn't worked and keep trying. And every once in a while, an acceptance comes along, and one acceptance and something showing up in print is immensely fulfilling and satisfying, and that will fortify you so that you can take the next 10 rejections in stride, knowing that eventually there'll be another acceptance, and on it goes. It's tough on the ego. It's, you know, this kind of writing, you're putting yourself out there on the line, and it's a little hard to be turned down on that kind of thing, but you know, the effort of continuing and trying to improve is rewarded in the end, and keep it up. I'm a little bit skeptical about how much you can learn by someone who sets out to teach you how to write. I don't think you can really be taught how to write, but I do think that spending time in the company of other writers in the way that, for example, Simon Fraser's Writer Studio program operates, where it's kind of an immersion experience. I haven't done it, but I've done things like it, where you're sharing your writing with others, you're getting feedback from other people, you've got people of recognized talent and ability to discuss writing and your writing with you and so on. These are helpful ways to bring yourself along as a writer. I have belonged for a long time to a group of a few writers who get together from time to time and share their work with each other and give honest and candid feedback. And I know that that's been beneficial. It's good in the sense that you learn something from what they tell you. It's good in the sense that when you have a meeting coming up, you darn well better have something written so that you can bring it there and share it with people. So it's a stimulus to get things written as well. So those are two bits of advice I would give.
Yeah, advice that would alter just so much. And I thank you so much for your time, Tom.
Well, thank you, Matthew. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Dear listeners, as you may have heard, Meta, which owns Instagram and Facebook, is blocking Canadian access to all content created by news providers, including this radio station, in response to the Online Broadcasting Act. Access to local news and information matters to everyone, and while radio stations use their airwaves to keep